You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world.
You. All right, we're on section 134 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. And, when we say bang, we're saying B-E-Y-N-G, which is Heidegger's alternative spelling of being. It's a different kind of being. And the book is, in a way, a look into what kind of being that is. So you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
134. The relation between Dasein and Bang was first grasped in Being and Time as an understanding of being, where understanding is meant in the sense of projection, and that in turn as throne, i.e. as belonging to an appropriation by Bang itself. If we now fail to recognize the strangeness and uniqueness, incomparability of Bang, and in unity with that, the essence of Dasein, then we will all too easily lapse into the opinion that this relation corresponds to, or is even identical with, the one between subject and object. Dasein, however, has overcome all subjectivity, and Bang is never an object, something we set over and against ourselves, something representable. Only beings can be objects, and not even all beings.
Yeah. So this section is about the relation between Dasein and Bang. And that relation was first grasped in his book Being and Time as an understanding of being. And understanding is meant there in the sense of projection, and that in turn as throne, i.e. as belonging to an appropriation by Bang itself. So the relation between Dasein and Bang is understood as conceived of as an understanding of Bang, but understanding here relates to the idea of Dasein being throne, which is sort of a core concept of his, meaning it is appropriated by Bang itself. It is projected outward. And if we fail to recognize the strangeness and uniqueness of Bang and the strangeness and uniqueness of Dasein, then we'll just start thinking of them as subject and object, Dasein being the subject, Bang being the object. But that is not what is going on, as he says. To me, I think the two interesting things about this section is one, in what way Dasein being thrown via an appropriation by Bang can be thought of as an understanding of being. And number two, if Dasein and Bang are not subject and object, what are they? How and why have they overcome that classic dichotomy? I think that to begin with, for Heidegger to sort of translate, as it were, an understanding of being as Dasein being thrown into an appropriation by Bang itself is his novel definition of what we think of as understanding. Understanding tends to be thought of as a kind of cognitive, categorical, logical, definition-based, linguistic formulation about something. You know, to understand it is to be able to aggregate propositions that one considers true about something. I guess proper to Heidegger's phenomenology and existentialism, that we have a sort of a more existential definition of what understanding is, and what he says is to understand something is essentially to have one's Dasein appropriated by Bang, and specifically to understand being is to have one's Dasein appropriated by Bang. Of course, being and Bang have a particular relationship. So it's just kind of a different.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, and then go ahead.
Can I say one thing? Are you moving off that topic?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I really like this idea that it's the understanding of being that creates the relationship between Dasein and Bang. It's just a really, different and specific way to think about it. And then also what you said about that the understanding is not like a logical, objective, word-based description, but it's this other thing that I think I get, but not fully yet.
Yeah, I mean, we often say I understand that, or I'm trying to understand that, or yeah. I'm understanding, or I'm seeking an understanding. And it's very valuable to ask ourselves, well, what do we mean by that, and how do we go about doing that, and what does that look like, and what's that process? And with these new concepts that Heidegger has given us, Dasein and Bang, and appropriation and thrownness and projection, it's good to have that new formula, that new positionality, as an understanding of what understanding is and what we're doing when we're trying to understand something.
Here's a question. Is he saying that the Dasein is what's being projected and thrown?
Yeah.
Okay, into the appropriation by Bang.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that parlays into the whole subject-object thing. I mean, I think that in general, when we talk about subject and object, we're talking about things that have a kind of conceptual integrity, in a sense, a staticness or a beyond time and space, transcendental quality, an idea of permanence and definability. And I think at the root of it, he's kind of saying Dasein is not a subject, because it as he says, it has overcome all subjectivity. So Dasein is more of a, shall we say, kind of a relation or an extension or a projection out and through the subject-object realm. So it lacks that kind of discrete positionality that we think of as subject. And Bang is never an object. Something that we can set ourselves over and against, something representable. So Bang is non-representable. It's not something we can position ourselves directly against or in contradistinction to, because Bang and Dasein are intricately related and appropriating and projecting through each other. And so this kind of dynamic intermingling space-time that they inhabit is much more, I guess I would say, sort of tangibly active and conceptually fluid than the standard subject-object dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so yeah, I guess we can read on.
Yeah. What if subjectivity and accordingly the relation to the objectivity of the object are grasped in the Kantian manner as transcendental? Beyond that, what if the object nature counted as the only experienceable being whereby objectivity would coincide with beingness? Would an opportunity not present itself here, and indeed a historically unique basic position on the basis of which the relation between Dasein and Bang could first be brought closer to our contemporaries by referring to the previous view in spite of all the essential differences? To be sure. And that is attempted in the Kant book, although it was possible only by doing violence to Kant in the sense of working out a more original version of precisely the transcendental project in its unity through an exposition of the transcendental imagination. This interpretation of Kant is, of course, incorrect historiologically, but it is essential historically, i.e. as relation to the preparation for
as
future...
As
related to the preparation for future thinking and only as so related. It is a historical directive toward something wholly other.
Yeah, so he brings up transcendental here, as I said transcendental a little bit ago, which is generally the way that the subject-object dichotomy is put forward, is through the idea of sort of transcendental unities. What if subjectivity...
Can you explain that, what that is?
Well, what transcendental unity is?
Yeah.
Well, it's just kind of the idea that there is a subject in you that persists and transcends time and space and is experienceable and relatable and representable and has a unity because it's persistent and it's the self or the ego or the identity. It's taken a lot of different forms, but it's the point in you that people sort of take as the node whereby you experience and relate to the world.
Okay.
And the object is the same thing, it's just outside you. So it transcends it transcends time and space in a way.
The unity of the subject and object, or the subject or the object?
Yeah, by unity, I just mean that, persists as the same over time and space. It has a self-unity. It's united to itself. So what if subjectivity and according to the relation of the objectivity of the object are grasped in the Kantian manner as transcendental? They generally are. Beyond that, what if the object nature counted as the only experienceable being whereby objectivity would coincide with beingness? And I'm not sure what he's doing with these what ifs, but let's keep reading. What if the subject and object were grasped as transcendental, and what if nature is the only experienceable being whereby objectivity would coincide with beingness? Nature probably just being sort of like what there is. Were these the case, would an opportunity not present itself here, and indeed a historically unique basic position on the basis of which there would be an opportunity, and on the basis of that opportunity, the relation between Dasein and Bang could first be brought closer to our contemporaries by referring to the previous view in spite of all the essential differences. I think he's saying that if we think of the subject-object dichotomy as transcendental, we think of nature as being what's objectively out there, there's an opportunity to think in terms of those templates, those formulas, in order to ask ourselves what's going on with Dasein and Bang, even if there are key differences between Dasein and Bang and the transcendental subject and object and the idea of an objective out there in nature. And then he goes on to say, to be sure, and that is what I tried to do in the Kant book. I tried to look at the way Kant thought of subject-object and nature and transcendentalism, the transcendental, and I tried to, despite the differences between what he was thinking and what I'm thinking, in terms of, about Dasein and being, I tried to sort of use those concepts to look at what we can learn about Dasein and being, despite the differences. And that's why it says it was incorrect historiologically. Mm-hmm. So maybe I wasn't doing a good historiology of what Kant was actually talking about or meaning to do or looking to have concluded from his theories. But it was important historically because we need to look back at Kant and look back at the thousands of years of concepts about subject and object in order to try to move genuinely and veritably into the relationship between Dasein and Bang.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Keep going?
Yeah. Just as surely as Kant's work is historiologically misconceived in such an interpretation, so there also falls into the same misconception that which is supposed to be brought nearer as the other, viz., what is to come. It seems we have here nothing else than an existential sort of Kantianism, or one modernized in some other way. Thus, if one maintains rightfully that Kant is historiologically distorted here, then one must also forego proposing as Kantian the basic position out of which and into which the distortion resulted. In other words, such historiological comparative reckoning does not touch what is essential. Historical confrontation, cf. The interplay, is precisely a procedure that just as much places the earlier history back into its hidden greatness, and to the same extent, but only to that extent, counterposes the other questioning, not for the sake of comparison, but in order to carry it out as compliance to that greatness and to its necessities. Sorry, I'm out of breath. I'm pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's just kind of talking about, thinking about Kant here. And he's saying that, it's important to go back and look at these great thinkers and try to jibe what we think with what they think. And that's the interplay. And we might not be giving a good faith interpretation of Kant. We might only be using him to kind of get to our own conclusions, but that's the nature of this kind of research, I think, is all basically what he's saying. Yeah. All right. I think you can keep going.
And so the Kant book is perforce thoroughly ambiguous, yet it is not a contingent offering because Kant is still the only one since the Greeks who brings the interpretation of beingness into a certain relation with time, and thereby becomes a witness to the hidden reign of the connection between beingness and time.
Yeah. Kant, I think he's just saying that if you're looking to understand being and time, then you look to the Greeks and you look to Kant, which is why I looked at Kant, he says. Yeah.
Nevertheless, for him, as already for the Greeks, thinking, logos, forms of judgment, categories, reason, remains primary in establishing the horizon for the interpretation of beings as such. Over and above this, and as a consequence of the procedure of Descartes, thinking as thinking gains mastery, and beings themselves become, on the same historical basis in each case, perceptum, the represented. That is, they become objects. Therefore, a grounding of Dasein could not be at issue here. In other words, the question of the truth of Bang cannot be raised in such a way.
Yeah, if you look at the Greeks with Logos and Kant and Descartes and the way that thinking generates being, thinking generates objects. The represented becomes the object of the thought, and perception links the subject to the object via reason and judgment and categories. That's what you see in those thinkers, and that is not how Dasein and Bang work at all. So we cannot gain direct knowledge of how Dasein and Bang work by looking at these thinkers, but we can participate in the interplay and begin to tell the difference, and through that difference hopefully come to see the unique strangeness of Dasein and Bang, as he says earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah. Do we want to do one more section?
Sure, let's read one more.
135. The essential occurrence of Bang as event. The relation between Dasein and Bang. The essential occurrence includes the appropriation... This essential occurrence includes the appropriation of Dasein. Accordingly, to speak in the strict sense of the relation of Dasein to Bang is misleading, inasmuch as it implies that Bang essentially occurs for itself and that Dasein then takes up a relation to Bang. The relation of Dasein to Bang pertains intrinsically to the essential occurrence of Bang itself, which could also be conveyed by saying that Bang needs Dasein and does not at all essentially occur without this appropriation. The appropriating event is so strange that it seems first to be completed through this relation to another, whereas its essential occurrence without the relation is indeed radically impossible. To speak of the relation of Dasein makes Bang ambiguous. It makes Bang into something over and against, which it is not. Inasmuch as it is... Inasmuch as it itself first appropriates precisely that which it is supposed to be over and against. Therefore, this relation is also utterly incomparable to the subject-object relation.
Yeah, so he starts to talk a little bit about what this relation between Dasein and Bang are about. The essential occurrence of Bang as event includes the appropriation of Dasein. So we cannot, really the gist of this section is to say that we cannot think of Bang without Dasein, and we cannot think of Dasein without Bang. That Bang as event involves the appropriation of Dasein, and Dasein involves being appropriated by Bang. To speak in the strict sense of the relation of Dasein to Bang is misleading, because when you talk about a relation, you talk about two distinct things that enter into a kind of interplay. And it implies that Bang occurs for itself and that Dasein then takes up a relationship to Bang, but that is not the way it works, he says. They are, as it were, intertwined, interdependent, interdefinitional, interpropositional. They need to be spoken of as unified in a way, as lending parts to each other, as integral to each other. The relation of Dasein to Bang pertains intrinsically to the essential occurrence of Bang itself. So Bang's essential occurrence involves a relationship to Dasein. Its relationship to Dasein helps it be, essentially. Bang needs Dasein and does not at all essentially occur without this appropriation. So Bang wouldn't be occurring if Dasein were not there to be appropriated by it and to, in a sense, be involved with it. The appropriating event, in other words, the event that appropriates Dasein, is so strange that it seems first to be completed through this relation to another. So the event becomes completed by its relation to Dasein, whereas its essential occurrence without the relation is indeed radically impossible. It would not occur without this relation. To speak of the relation of Dasein makes Bang ambiguous. It makes Bang into something over and against. again, to speak of a relation between Dasein and Bang is not quite correct because it turns Bang into an object. And this relation is, in fact, utterly incomparable to the subject-object relation. I just kind of think he's saying that Dasein and Bang do not relate to each other in the way that two separate entities that maintain their integral separateness within an interplay and a relation, that is not how Dasein and Bang work. They are interconnected. They occur with each other and via each other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's enough, right?
Yeah.
Enough reading?
Yeah.
Is there something you wanted to talk about?
I do not have anything on my mind.
You have nothing on your mind?
I mean, I don't know. I felt kind of bad complaining about the pregnancy stuff last time.
Were you complaining about it?
I don't know if I was complaining about it, but it just felt like kind of a throwback to like my second pregnancy and like complaining about it on the podcast. I don't know.
Part of it, were you complaining about it? I don't remember.
Contradictory.
Like, your caregivers?
Yeah. Medical advice.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make sense. Right up. Anyways, so I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But that's a big thing on my mind, I guess. I was listening to one of our earlier episodes, and I think it was just a few ago, and you said something like, liberals walk around like an open wound. And it really struck me in listening back. I was thinking just about a couple examples, and I have no idea how it relates to the reading or if it does, but it's been on my mind. There's a way, like my masseuse is very liberal. And when I ask him how he is, he's like, oh, well, okay, or you know, and I know in what he's saying that, oh well, it's terrible because the world is terrible. Basically everything is terrible. And I get this also like with my parents. I feel like when I ask how they are, I get this feeling that it's like, oh well, no, it's everything's terrible because the world is terrible. And I feel that, I get that feeling also with anxiety, that there's this real like, which is part of why it feels very liberal to me to have anxiety, is that there's this feeling that's like, you can say, oh, how is everything? It's like, well, everything can be great or everything can be fine or whatever. But then there's still, when in the grips of anxiety, I feel like there's still this feeling that it's actually always terrible, even if it's actually always fine, actually fine. I was thinking about that today.
Why do you think it's always terrible?
With liberalism or with anxiety
Yeah.
I mean, I think with anxiety, it's because, oh, well, something terrible could happen, or because I have a sense of anxiety, everything actually is terrible. With liberalism, I think it's the idea that there's something terrible going on right now somewhere, and that is terrible.
Yeah.
Which I guess if I were to relate it, I feel like there's a very objective presence there because it's a very like through line of and sort of lived experience, like a feeling of something being made concrete and objective.
Yeah. Yeah, we've talked about it before, but it's that idea of the liberal world.
Yeah.
How liberals think the world is going to pot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is there something in like the subject-object relation or bang?
Yeah. I was going to say, that reminds me a little bit about one thing I was thinking is, like, we were listening to that Rufo and what's his name?
Yeah, Lomas.
Right. And they were sort of talking about, they were trying to get to the basis of third worldism, and they were talking about all these sort of facets of liberal thinking. And, you know, are liberals obsessed mostly with economic disparities and redistribution, or is it more race communism? So it's just sort of that they hate white people, or as Lomas was saying, is that they just hate like the white chud, you know, the guy who runs like a sprinkler company. You know, I don't know. These are the examples he was using. And I was thinking that, you know, I feel like there's kind of a pattern taking place, or a diffusion and a separation taking place in American culture, where there's people who make a living, which is very important to people, how they gain their livelihood. And I think the security of one's livelihood and the facts of one's livelihood and the possibilities of one's livelihood and then have an incredibly powerful, often not even discussed, causative role in how one thinks about politics and where one thinks politics should be taking us. And I think that, you know, there's this quote, I don't know who said it, but it's, you know, there's two kind of businesses, one that makes things that people need and one that makes things that people don't. And obviously the business that makes things that people don't need or don't want, maybe it's want. Maybe it's things people want. Those businesses obviously go out of business. And I feel like when Lomas is like, oh, they just hate white chuds, I think actually what he's kind of pointing at is that there's a large swath of the American people who gain their livelihood by making things that people want and need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people talk about plumbers and, you know, people who make things and cars and work with their hands and people who sell products and people who run stores and people who all that they're really saying is that those are people who have chosen a livelihood based on things that people actually about providing actual needs and wants from people. When you switch over to other things, and those people tend to be, I would say, conservative, or Republican, or conservatives, or MAGA, or whatever you want to call it. On the other side, you have a large swath of the American public who are making things that, yeah, people need them and want them, but they're kind of often not life's necessities. And those people need to spend a lot of time manifesting and preaching and publicizing and orchestrating thought patterns that ensure that people want their products. So, for instance, if you think about the average, a lot of the liberals, you know, for instance, take the arts, right? You hear it constantly from the artists how we can't survive without the arts, and the arts make us what we are, and we need the arts to solve these problems, and we need the arts for community, and we need, so artists spend all this time trying to convince people that they want art. Plumbers spend zero time trying to convince people that when their toilet is clogged, they're going to want a plumber. because they literally just are serving an immediate need. People need cars. People need new tires. People need food on their table, right? People need clothes on their body. People need their house to be operating efficiently. People need the plane to land. People need, you know, there's a lot of things that people actually need, and they don't need to be talked into needing it. But, you know, all the professors, mm-hmm. all the NGOs, all the services that are busy handing out philanthropy and care, and, you know, they have to spend a lot of time maintaining a definition of the world that serves their industry persisting.
Yeah.
Right? So liberalism becomes propaganda and becomes brochuring mm-hmm. and advertising and ideologizing just by default, because mm-hmm. most of the liberal industries you could kind of do without unless you believe in the liberal order. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I guess how does that fit? I mean, I think, you know, plumbers don't sit around and get anxious about whether people are going to need plumbers.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to need plumbers. Liberals sit around and get really anxious that people aren't going to need gender studies professors. Mm-hmm. Or people aren't going to need whatever social service they're providing. Or I know a very close, intimate person of mine who is, you know, studying to be a climate scientist. Right? Yeah. And she is incredibly anxious about the idea that we might not need or want climate scientists in the future.
Yeah.
And so she spends a lot of time engaged in liberal ideological formation mm-hmm. and impressment onto others to make sure that climate science, everybody understands that it's incredibly important and we need lots of it. Mm-hmm. So she has a job. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how that quite relates to what you're saying, but I think that there's something about...
Yeah, it also reminds me of something... Oh, sorry. Were you done?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. Like, I think, in other words, anxiety... When you're living in on the side of the economy where what you're doing... Mm-hmm. is not really needed. It's only kind of in demand because people are buying into an idea. Mm-hmm. The preservation of that idea is going to riddle you with anxiety mm-hmm. because you either keep that idea strong in the public mind or you lose your job. And I think that's at the root of what Lomas was saying when he was saying they don't like white chuds who run plumbing companies. Mm-hmm. What he's really saying is they resent the people who have accepted and chosen jobs where need and demand and want are first and foremost, and you just simply serve those needs and demands. Mm-hmm. Liberals feel that's a little beneath them. Mm-hmm. That's a little too servile. Right? It's a little mm-hmm. too like, oh, you just offer a product to people mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. tell you what kind of product they want. Like, where are you in that? You've sold out. You've lost your humanity. It's really wrapped up in that kind of thinking.
Is porn a necessity or not?
So, again, I'm not talking this. Not everything is a necessity.
That's sort of a more that would some, fall.
As
on
I
the
said,
side
it's a want or a need.
A want or a need? Yeah.
You know, like there are people. There, you know. It is porn. I mean, porn is something that I don't think you really need to like believe in some complicated ideological political formulation like liberal progress.
Right.
To decide if you're going to watch some porn.
Well,
one night.
There's a lot of liberal ideological organization that goes into convincing people that they should not be watching porn, actually.
Yeah.
I would say, if anything.
Yeah.
Something else I found interesting about the podcast.
There's a lot of conservatives who do that too, by the way.
Yeah, sure. That's true.
But porn is just a product.
Yeah.
It's literally like a movie.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it's just a product.
Yeah. One other thing he brought up, or they brought up, was wokeism. And I found it, I mean, kind of obvious. Like, I'm not sure why I hadn't thought of this before, but interesting that they were talking about it as basically a psychological indoctrination attempt to, I guess, you know, have white people feel guilty. I mean, we know this. And they had some other ways to talk about it, but I hadn't, for some reason in a while, thought about it in terms of, I mean, all of this, and as well as the third worldism, could just be put as that. It's like a, like, it's sort of what you're saying, trying to convince people that they need something, that they are a certain way, that they...
Yeah, I mean, wokeism is a great example, because wokeism is just a massive broadcasting, publication, propaganda machine designed to change the way people think about very core ideas. You know, and again, like, so, but why? You know, you can say, well, it's for justice, it's for truth, it's for progress. Yes. But I'm not sure a lot of those people would be doing that if they weren't working for, say, a publication that requires people needing that kind of thinking so that they'll buy their articles, or for organizations that are seeking charitable giving in order to then go out and do the kind of work that furthers that kind of social agenda. I mean, I'm just kind of reminded of, you know, I know someone who works at the ACLU, and I know for a fact that in 2016, when Trump was elected, for the several months after, you know, ACLU donations went through the roof, and they probably have continued to go through the roof. And of course, you can look at every philanthropical or charitable organization or NGO, you know, they now use Trump to fundraise. So I don't know where I was going with that, but you know, it's liberal thought.
You said it's a propaganda machine.
Yeah, woke. Yeah, woke.
That's really well said.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean.
But I think the deeper issue here is that I think if we're thinking about the liberal mindset and the liberal thinking, is the way that, you know, kind of through the back door, ideological propaganda and political position formation and broadcasting spinning stories about what's right and wrong is hardwired and packed into into liberalism now. I think most people on the liberal side of the aisle feel that their livelihood is dependent on people believing in the liberal project, which is why Trump was so disarming, is that the liberal project is now threatened and all of these people's livelihoods is threatened. I mean, the NGOs are being dismantled and the funding is drying up and DEI is against the law, and you know, and of course everybody says this is fascism and this is evil, but it's actually just democracy, and it's actually just they don't like that their wallets are being affected. And it's weird because I would say that people on the conservative side aren't really vulnerable in that way. Because when liberals come into power, what are they going to do? They're going to say, you know what? You can't make cars. You can't make food. You can't fix the plumbing, and you can't fix the roads. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's what we're really talking about in terms of professions here. Like, for instance, the universities could go away and nothing would change. People would figure out other ways to you know, and that's the other thing is, like, I would say probably AI is threatening people on the liberal side to a much greater degree than it's threatening people on the much needed services side.
Yeah.
I mean, the university as an idea is finally being seen as fairly corrupt, and the universities are probably going to start shrinking. Teachers and white collar creatives and lawyers and these kind of things, you know. So liberals, it's a stressful time for liberals.
Yeah.
I mean, it always is, but.
I mean, is that sort of, do you think, related to the feeling of like the open wound nature of, because you're like, oh, I feel like there's always, yeah, if you're always trying to prove something, or like, I don't know, or is that kind of a stretch?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think liberals feel really taken advantage of. They feel really unappreciated. They feel really on edge. They feel like they have to constantly be involved in like convincing the idiots of the world that what liberalism is selling them is something they need to pay for. Mm-hmm. They feel, I think deep down, there's a sense of irrelevance. There's a sense of superfluity. There's a sense of being elite. And there's a sense of providing unnecessary services. I think there's a sense of resentment. I mean, I know in the arts, for instance, if your art is not being paid for or seen or appreciated, you have two paths. You can say, well, I must not really be doing what's good, and I need to fight harder to get my muse to really deliver on some shit. Or you can say people are fucking stupid and the system is corrupt and America is filled with idiotic chuds and what a terrible world we live in. Mm-hmm. And the liberal way is the latter. Mm-hmm. And it's not just in the arts, and it's in everything. So I think, you know, why do liberals think everybody's stupid? Well, because they're most of them are essentially engaged in the process of trying to sell things to people that it's really important that those people drink the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are unwilling to drink the Kool-Aid, and so the best liberal reaction to that is, well, you're just obviously stupid. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then how would you relate that to, like, anxiety?
Well, again, I think that it seems to go back down to this constitutional or, I don't know what it is, elite resistance or pejorative attitude toward a life of providing products to people. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's just like, liberals don't go to school to learn how to make and sell things that people need. That's seen as beneath them. Mm-hmm. It's seen as kind of primitive and a little bit like old industrial and is slavish. I think that there's like a freedom. There's like a, I don't know what it is. It's like a, you know, it really is, you know, a resistance to a slavishness or a service mentality, mm-hmm. to serve people. Mm-hmm. Liberals are by and large the people for whom that is beneath them.
Kind of like being a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
That's right. And so when that's your kind of position, is that you're repulsed by the idea of providing services to people, because then really, you know, the customer's always right. And so you're just going to have to live in that kind of mentality and be a server, mm-hmm. right? If you're above that, then you've got to figure out a way to make money off people when you're not serving them. Mm-hmm. And that is incredibly anxiety inducing. I mean, if you just think about it in that context. So go, young person, out into the world, and you're going to spend the next 60 years trying to hack a living out of the wilderness, wherein you're not really trying to do something for people that they need or want. You're spending most of your time trying to convince them that they should mm-hmm. want you and need you. Mm-hmm. And so you're a moralizer, you're a proselytizer, you're an advocate, and you're spending most of your time trying to talk people into things. Mm-hmm. And so you're anxious.
Yeah, I feel like you're also pointing to this idea that sort of in doing things that are more of a want or need, it's also just seen as not living up to your potential or not doing something important or something really valuable, I guess, as well. So, like, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, I think, recently about, like, the stay-at-home mom or trad wife movement, or maybe that's
yeah.
discussion's been going on for a while, but, like, just this idea that to actually find satisfaction in just serving your family and raising right. kids is, like, for me, I mean, it's a really hard thing to, like, feel confident in, to be like, oh, if I can just raise three great kids, that's awesome, right? Like, that should be awesome. That's a lot. That should be awesome.
Well, it is awesome, and you do think it's awesome. You do think it's often.
I do.
But you also have a career, and you also have career ambitions.
Yes. But I also think that the liberal perspective that is within me on it,
yeah,
doesn't find satisfaction in it, and instead right. is like, well, but you're missing all these things, or
right.
in doing that,
right.
in finding satisfaction, you shouldn't in a way find satisfaction in it, I guess.
Well, yeah. And that,
the whitewashing.
Well, yeah. And I think that, and that cuts really deep in the liberal mindset too, because, you know, obviously if you're a mom raising kids and there's a man in the house, then obviously you are subservient to him. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, would be nice if that were the case, but that's obviously not the case. So, but there's this assumption that
it's all the propaganda. It's just all the messaging around it. All the propaganda is really what I'm thinking more.
You're half
about.
A person. You're a subjected person. Yeah. You're an enslaved person. I think... I find great satisfaction in raising children. I love children. I love my children. I love serving my children. But I have very powerful career ambitions for myself that has nothing to do with my children. However, I think that my attitude about my career and my writing specifically is that, I wake up every day and I say, well, I better write something that people want to hear. Mm-hmm. Or... I'm gonna be relegated to the dustbin of history. Mm-hmm. I've never ever partaken in any kind of advocacy or art speak or like running around telling people that they should like my work mm-hmm. or they're stupid if they don't. Or it's completely alien to me. And so I live in terms of my writing. I live in the service mentality. Mm. Now, some people might say, are you kidding me, Kirk? Like, look at your plays. Like, they're so, out there. And, like, obviously you're not just handing people stuff on a dish. You're not just, like, writing cheap romance. And my point would be, actually, I'm just trying to find a market niche. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to exploit a niche in the literary world that I think is not filled and where there's a gap. Mm-hmm. And I am actually trying to just write stuff that people will like. But obviously my audience is people who like some very hyper literary and often very complicated stuff. But there's people like that out there, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to reach them. Mm-hmm. But I exist completely in the service mentality. And, you know, I find that noble and awesome and the way it should be. I don't feel denigrated mm-hmm. by the idea that I'm trying to write what people like. I actually find that relationship to be really rewarding and really valuable and actually super informative to my genius, you know, my genius in the, to my genius, you know, to my creative mind, mm-hmm. you know, that's, I look to that for creative insight and creative impetus. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of writers who don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm in New Dramatists. There's something like 65 writers in there. And I would say a lot of them depend on kind of woke ideologies and identitarian aesthetic formulas being in vogue. Mm-hmm. And if those formulas are not in vogue, nobody is going to want to look at their work because mm-hmm. their work has zero literary value outside of just being reverberations and echoes and repetitions of identitarian ideological fake art. Mm-hmm. And so they are incredibly invested in the idea that these identitarian agendas that they've been pushing for over a decade now persist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that makes them very anxious. Mm-hmm. And it's really violent and dangerous to them that people would come around and say these identitarian categories are shallow and vapid and stupid because that just renders their work completely useless. Mm-hmm. Whereas my view of my work is actually that I'm trying to capture the human experience. I have no fear that the human experience is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. So I'm not involved in propagating any kind of worldview that I really feel must persist or my work is going to all of a sudden become irrelevant. I'm actually just trying to more thoroughly and more interestingly capture the human experience. I'm not relying on any kind of politicized categories. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really anxious about it. I'm actually just kind of thinking, well, I'm either going to get really good at it and people are going to want to hear it or I'm not. So I don't know, I guess maybe, and I think maybe that feels very connected to my non-liberalism. Mm-hmm. My kind of, in a sense, reverence for the service perspective feels emotively and cognitively very formulaic in my being non-liberal. They feel really almost very similar. Mm-hmm. So I would say what I was going to say about your momness, right? You're a perfect mother. I tell you that every day. You're raising children. You're doing it. You're serving them. I think it comes really naturally to you. I don't think you think, oh, I'm serving them. I think you love them. You find them adorable and it just emanates, the care emanates from you naturally. But you're also an aspiring artist. So I guess what I would ask is, an aspiring artist, by the way, who for about a decade, and we talked about this in another episode, felt drawn or was drawn to trying to formulate ideologies that might perpetuate a need for your work. Mm-hmm. We talked about you self-defining as a feminist artist, mm-hmm. or that people should or need to value art coming from your particular vocation perspective. And right?
Yeah.
And I think it's been, I don't know, like talk about that, because I don't know, what's your relationship to the idea of artist as just serving the public?
I mean, I think it didn't really work, you know, or I mean, actually, maybe I should say actually worked really well. I was written about an art form because of it, you know, I mean, in a number of ways, it actually got me
but it stopped
a lot
working.
Of press. Well, it stopped working because
that shit is not in vogue.
It's not in vogue. Yeah, that's right.
And that's the danger of that kind of stuff. And
it was
and
in vogue in 2015, 2016, and then it left.
Yeah. And that's been very anxiety-inducing for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I would say that definitely my newest work is not at all related to that narrative. Yeah, anxiety-inducing. I mean, I don't know. I think for me, the anxiety I don't see quite as related. Like, for me, the anxiety is not... Or I don't know. I don't think it's
about your art.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think as you were talking, I was like, I feel like. I mean, I think that it's a liberal anxiety that I've sort of placed from politics onto myself. Basically, that's how I've described it. And I think it's like, and as you're just saying it, I do think that there's something about like, you know, when you really have something that you want, like a picture of how, let's say, your day goes or the thoughts you have, and that doesn't happen. So like something out in the world that you want, and then that doesn't happen, then that's like upsetting. And that feels like a parallel of how I put that anxiety kind of from politics or from art or from something kind of onto circumstances I'm in.
Yeah, I think your anxiety is something that you inherited.
Yeah.
And you inherited it from some very liberal people.
Yeah.
And if you look at those liberal people, you can see sort of a microcosm of what I've been describing. I mean, I think the people who handed you your anxiety have lived a life of being very anxious about the direction the world is going in.
Definitely.
And the beliefs that the world is embracing. And the evils that are emerging in the world, and very involved in trying to shape the primary direction of the world's commitments and ideas.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
there's something to kind of letting go of that feels a little, that feels traitorous. Traitorous? Yeah.
Letting go of...
Like, I'm not trying to shape that.
Right.
Like, I'm not trying...
Right. Right.
To do any of those things anymore.
Right.
Was I trying to do it at one point, though? That's, I mean, I guess you're pointing out that in my art I was. Somewhat.
Yeah. You've never struck me as somebody who's really heavily involved in that project.
Yeah.
But I think ironically, I'm not sure you ever, I don't think you possess that constitutional aversion to service. I don't think it's natural to you. I don't think I think you accept the idea that work is work and that you you need to do something that people want, or they're not going to want it, and they're not going to, nothing's going to happen for you.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that puts you as part of the Chud class, which is the.
You know, I think that calling that something that Chuds have that Chuds do more than others is ridiculous. I mean, there's people all around that just basically spend their days trying to make things and serve things to people that they want and need. Everything from a surgeon to a farmer to, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's all kinds of people.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's an interesting thing about OBGYNs versus midwives, right?
Yeah.
Midwives need to maintain to perpetuate the idea that natural uninduced childbirth needs to be valued.
Mm-hmm.
Or their whole profession is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they're very liberal.
Yeah.
You know, OBGYNs probably are too, maybe, but I don't know. Maybe the theory doesn't hold everywhere, but.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to ask yourself, so what, you know, what is the root of what is obviously liberals looking down on the what we could call the professions?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they look down?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that beneath them? Why is that something they would never do? And again, I guess. It just really is seen as servile and unfree and demeaning and bestial and basic and beneath them and non-creative.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been sort of suspect of like the religiosity of the artist. I think there's a lot of propaganda in the schools now about how the noble professions are the ones where you're kind of like being creative,
yeah,
which so often just turns into like working for a nonprofit organization trying to push something, you know, like how many creative professions are there out there really, you know? So there's, you know, I mean, it's an old thing. The aristocracy doesn't work with their hands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the vita contemplativa versus the vita activa. It's like the active, involved life, and also you can't understate how, you know, being a capitalist, working in the service economy, making products, selling things that people want and need, requires a full embrace of the idea that you are there for someone else. And liberalism tells people you should be there only for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what does that have to do with anxiety?
That's
what you want to know.
No, I wasn't. I was actually wondering if there was a way to relate it back to the reading, but I don't know, maybe. I'm not sure it does relate.
Well, I could go so far as to say that I think liberals are stuck in the transcendental subject-object dichotomy.
Yeah.
The subject-object dichotomy does go back far, but it finds a great deal of flourishing in, as Heidegger points out, Kant, but also in Hegel. And from Hegel, we get the master-slave relationship, and from the master-slave relationship and from Hegel in general, we end up with Marxism. And in Marxism, you have the oppressor and the oppressed, and this is subject-object. You have the self and the other. You have and liberal frameworks of humanity and the economy and everything rely on this kind of these dichotomies of unities, the rich and the poor, the white and the black. Identitarianism is inherently based on transcendental subjects and objects. So that's all very classic liberal, and that's how liberals think now. Now, Dasein and Bang are being appropriated by Bang. Dasein being appropriated by Bang is, in a sense, Heidegger's way of saying you know, when you're working to provide things that people want and need and you're serving them in that, they are appropriating you. Mm. You're being appropriated by them. It's a fluid relationship. It's not a static. It's not over and against each other. Mm-hmm. You're really there for each other. And there's not one without the other. And they're in a dance of mutual benefit. For liberals, all subject-object oppositions are antagonistic and zero-sum games when it comes to power. Mm-hmm. Somebody has power and somebody doesn't have power. Well, who has the power when I hire a plumber? Right? Mm-hmm. There's no power. There's no oppressor and oppressed. I give the plumber $1,000 probably, and the plumber makes my sewers flow. Mm-hmm. Everybody benefits. Nobody walks away going, oh, he's a, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he has power over me. No, everybody's happy. Everybody gets something. That's Dasein Bang right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't have anything to add, so yeah.
All right, good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.